This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, full immersion fantasy, the appeal of RPG.
So, weirdly enough, this is one that I suggested. I say weirdly enough, like I don't contribute to anything.
So I don't think anybody's going to be surprised that this one was your idea, Madeline.
What are you trying to say?
I'm just saying that the astute listener will have added up clues such as dragoning and murder mystery parties and then, you know, they'll have come to a conclusion and, you know, it'll be a tiny step. It won't even be a big leap.
Okay, guilty as charged. But in all fairness, this is a pretty big topic and we hadn't really touched on it. So I thought that that it was time to look at it.
Yeah, definitely.
So for any of our listeners who don't know what RPG is, it stands for role play game.
I was going to be annoying then and interrupt with rocket propelled grenade, which it does, but obviously not in this context.
I knew you were going to do something like that.
I'm sorry, look, trust me, you can't live with Alan for 12 years and not sort of get that thing, those sort of terms indoctrinated. It's just one of those things. I'm not suggesting everyone else tries to live with Alan, because then you'd end up living with me and it would be a whole thing and the house just really isn't big enough for that, but just trust me on this one.
She only has room for in her cellar for one person who she plans to imprison at a later date.
Yeah, the chair's already got your name on it.
Oh, thanks, Jules.
I thought you'd feel loved.
Yeah, I do. all weirdness aside, so it stands for role-playing game. And it exists in various forms. So really, the RPG in a form that we can instantly recognise it and has its origins in tabletop games. So that's kind of where it starts. That involves, you know, either a board or maps or dice or something along those lines, and a bunch of nerds sitting around a table. I say that with great affection because I'm one of those nerds. Okay? So that's the tabletop game. But it doesn't stop there. You also have LARPing. It's all about the abbreviations today.
It really is.
So LARPing is live-action role-playing, where not only do you play these games, you actually dress up as these characters and go out into the world. That sounds really menacing. Like, for the most part, when people are LARPing, they will go to a specific location to LARP with other LARPers. They won't just dress up in armor and hit the streets of London. I mean, a few people probably will, but... Yeah, you have conventions and big games and group and who LARP. Some people call it reenactment. And people who call it reenactment would defy anyone saying it's LARPing, but it is. It's
I was going to say, a you're subsection just... is in fact historical reenactment. And you have massive groups of people who, for example, keep redoing the Battle of the Alamo and they keep redoing the Civil War, you know, as if there's going to be a different conclusion this time. but no, in all fairness, if I was going to LARP, it would be a case of I might look at sort of medieval reenactment if I was allowed to not be a lady, basically. If I was confined to the roles that everyone believes historically accurate for women, then you can sort of sod off, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I feel the same way. And we're actually going to touch on that a little bit later in terms of why role play is so satisfying and why so many people are attracted to it. So you have LARPing, and then you obviously have video games as well. So from D&D and from the tabletop game, video games have kind of really, really gotten a lot bigger in terms of what they can offer for role play, particularly sandbox games, which have this open world where not only can you choose your character, can you choose the way that they look, you can actually then make pretty much all of their decisions. So you can decide, are they going to seduce this person? Are they going to kill this person? Those aren't the only two options. You can, you know, ignore them as well. But sometimes, in some games, those are the only two options. Either you love them or you kill them. But you can make these decisions, and these decisions will then have an effect on which way you go. And it's been amazing to see how that's developed. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Finally, you do have other kind of laughing things in terms of murder mystery games, which are also, I feel, a form of RPG. Now, I think the main thing that we're talking about here is because there's lots of different ways that you can kind of role play, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But the point of this episode is specifically to look at forms of role playing where there is an objective which you are trying to meet. So you're not just acting. You're not just saying, right, I'm going to do this. You are actually doing something yourself. You are making your own decisions, and you are having, it's not completely scripted. So there are some forms of murder mystery games where it is, and there are other forms where it isn't, and you can conceal things and you can say things or do certain things. You can even commit an actual murder. I don't recommend that. It kind of spoils the fun for a lot of people. Not all of them, but like most of them. It's also illegal, so don't do that. Sorry.
I think the line between fantasy and reality really blurred there, didn't it?
It's very hot, in my defence. my brain is being steamed as we speak. Okay, so those are I'm sure there are other forms of role play as well, but those are kind of the most basic pillars within the role playing community. So now, let's look at a brief history of roleplay. And this is actually quite a funny story.
Okay.
In terms of, I'm just going to talk about the brief history of Dungeons & Dragons. Now, Dungeons & Dragons, I don't think anyone, whether or not you play it, everyone has heard of Dungeons & Dragons. It's the epitome of nerd. And weirdly enough, it was something which was kind of very niche back in the day, which only certain communities would kind of do and look down upon. And now it's become a lot more mainstream, I think, in terms of, you still get a lot of nerds playing it, but I think more and more people are sort of engaged with the idea of it, literally because of video games and the way that they've been popularized, where people suddenly go, wait, I can take it a step further. I can not only come up with my character, I can come up with their entire background. I can have a lot more kind of control over certain things. So D&D has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and there are so many variants of it. It was originally designed by Gary Gygax, I think that's how you say his name, and David Arneson. And it was first published in 1974. And it's basically had so many variants ever since then. It just took off. It was hugely popular. My favourite thing about the whole D&D thing, though, is that it was so closeted back in the day that when Gary Gygax was originally it was based on the idea of war games, which you would also, you know, it was which were kind of form of tabletop. And he was so into them, but he didn't really tell anyone he was into them. And he would just continue to sneak off and spend a lot of time away, to the point that his wife thought he was having an affair. Right? she thought he was having an affair. And so one day she snuck in. And she went down to confront him. I think they were in the basement or something like that. Yeah, it was in his friend's basement, and she snuck in and she threw open the doors ready to confront him, and just found him and his sort of like hunched over a table which was covered in maps. They were like, oh, we've been discovered. I'm not having an affair, I'm a nerd. I just think it's one of the best stories ever.
That would have been a really interesting conversation. It's like, well, you know, you being a nerd would have been kind of a turn off before, but then I thought you were fucking someone else, so finding you hunched over a pile of maps and a handful of dice was actually kind of a relief.
It's just the idea that he spent so much time doing it and just didn't talk about it at all, that that's where she went. She had no idea that that's kind of what he was doing. Which does sort of suggest that there is a certain element of taboo, but not taboo exactly, but embarrassment that was associated with it, which you just don't get now. I mean, the perfect epitome of what D&D represents is Strange Things, where you see all of them playing D&D, and they're very clearly meant to be the outcast kids, you know.
Yeah, and then there's a whole bunch of authors who, having made it on the fantasy scene, have then sort of said, oh, well, yeah, I used to do this D&D tabletop type stuff, and I've got a bunch of friends who, you know, are now, or they're either at the beginning of their publishing careers or they're well established, and like, oh, yeah, I did D&D for years, and it's not quite the same as someone saying, oh, yeah, I used to do heroin, but I've given it up now. Or, I used to train spot, and it's got its own niche cool factor, even when people go, oh, yeah, that's a bit weird and a bit sad.
Yeah, and it's gotten cooler and cooler, I think, actually. More and more people are doing it. People who you wouldn't have thought doing it at all.
I mean, I have to say, having read Mark Lawrence's latest couple of books, which focus on this group of teenage lads and a space-time continuum issue, and the fact they all know each other and are friends because of their D&D days. And that's what they do. They get together once a week and play D&D. I sort of feel that I missed out a bit, because at the age where I would have been getting into this, I found martial arts instead and basically joined that cult.
Yes.
So instead of becoming a Dungeons & Dragons nerd, I became a really intense martial artist. I'm not sure if that's better or worse, to be honest. Because there was a certain level of role-playing.
It certainly has real-life applications, to be honest.
It does, but I mean, you could say that Dungeons & Dragons has real-life applications in terms of problem-solving and teamwork. So, and they're probably slightly more transferable than being able to kick someone in the face.
True. But that being said, being is awesome. Also, it's never too late to get into D&D. As I've discovered, having just gotten into D&D, I do realise you're a little bit older than me, Jules. But still, we'll lure you in.
It's never too late, except for Jules.
That's not what I'm saying.
Jules is really over the hill for this now. She should be settling down and doing sensible things.
No, I was saying it's never too late, and then I was conscious that at any moment you were like, yeah, but I'm older than you, so I was acknowledging that you're older than me, and I'm saying it's not too late. This has come out all wrong. I'm going to move on. absolutely. D&D, Dungeons & Dragons, has been a major influence on role play. It's kind of seen as the founder of tabletop role playing, which in turn has massively influenced every other form ever since. But one thing I do want to touch on is actually to go back and look at the influence of past writers on D&D, just very briefly. And I think one of the biggest things is Tolkien. Lord of the Rings had a massive influence on Dungeons and Dragons. Whether people want to accept it or not, it's true. In terms of the way that all of the creatures which kind of exist are all from the same vein as Tolkien, who obviously had a massive influence on fantasy of that era anyway, because it had never been done before, and then suddenly everyone wanted more Tolkien.
Yeah.
And so suddenly the market was saturated with books which were all kind of the same. So it's not really that much of a stretch. It's not really that much of a leap to suddenly find that tabletop games would have echoed that massive influx of that sort of high fantasy.
No, and as you say, Tolkien had a massive influence on fantasy. In fact, you could argue that all fantasy of the epic variety and all its subsidiaries kind of grew up in the shadow of Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of like mushrooms. And now it's sort of all going off in its own direction. And we're getting a lot more less Eurocentric, less European myth-based, less European history-based fantasy, or something that's certainly a lot more inclusive in that respect. But, I mean, I don't think Tolkien was actually setting out to be a trendsetter. He just liked spending time with his elves and his orcs and Middle-earth, and he wanted to write a mythology of you know, the British people, because we were conquered in our... Basically, we were conquered and our nations were so mixed that all our mythology became very mixed, and there wasn't a clear narrative thread like you get with say, like the epics in Ireland and Wales and Scotland, so...
like we don't have epics, we've been invaded too much.
It's like, yeah, we've got those myths, but we've got those ones as well, and it's just, you know, things got lost. So I can kind of see his point there. And on the other hand, yeah, fantasy definitely needs to keep going in other directions, and I think it's great that sort of RPG is one of those directions.
Yeah, absolutely. Interestingly enough, then, from, and as you've said, Jules, a lot of writers did actually play Dungeons and Dragons, and then went on to sort of be writing their own thing. So it's, of course, no big stretch that they would have been influenced by the game as well. To the extent that you have certain words and certain themes and certain creatures which all appear, which they come from Tolkien, but via Dungeons and Dragons. And it's actually small little things, and I got picked up on this actually, light armor. For instance.
Yeah.
Light armor. Light armor. When I was saying light armor, I meant kind of like leather armor. I had a very clear image in my mind, except light armor as a term comes from Dungeons and Dragons. So someone picked me up on this and they just said, it just, this is all of this fantasy we're seeing right now, which is just coming out of the back end of Dungeons and Dragons. And I don't think they meant it kindly. Which I don't think is particularly fair, but I can understand that Dungeons and Dragons has had this massive influence on modern writers as well, because weirdly enough, it's more accessible than Tolkien for some people, but it contains all of the things that people love about Tolkien's books.
Yeah, definitely. While we're talking about sort of the tabletop RPG, I want to take a little detour through the world of darkness.
Okay.
This is the world of darkness. So, this isn't high fantasy. This is more kind of urban fantasy slash horror. And I'm talking, of course, about Vampire the Masquerade. And obviously there's Vampire the Requiem, but the really popular one, the one that everyone comes back to, is Vampire the Masquerade. I don't know how much you know about it, Madeline.
Nothing.
It was slightly before your time, in fairness. It's still going. It's still kind of a cult classic. It's not something that I personally have ever been involved in, but I've kept bumping into the story, if you like, into the world throughout my life. And I feel I know quite a bit about it now, not least because Alan's a massive fan of the world building. So when he says, oh, yeah, well, you know, if we're watching a vampire film, and he said, yeah, I can see that vampire being a toreador. I'm like, yeah, I know exactly which clan you're talking about now, because for the last 12 years, I've, like, imbibed this by osmosis. Anyway, the way Vampire the Masquerade works is, instead of, obviously, your orcs and paladins and dwarfs and what have you that you'd have in Dungeons & Dragons, what you have is vampires, mages, although not very many people choose to play a mage, as I understand it. And you do have werewolves as well, but they're very sort of big earth spirit worshipping type creatures. And, you know, the whole being cursed as a werewolf. You're not cursed, you're not bitten, you're born one, so you are one or you're not. But the big focus is the vampires. And the reason the vampires are such a big focus are they kind of run everything, you know, they run shit. And the whole premise is that there's this masquerade. The masquerade is making the humans believe that the vampires don't exist. And within that, you have various different clans. So you've got like the Ventru, who are very good at running things. You've got the Toreador, who are like passionate about the arts. You've got the Gangrels, the Bruja, and a whole bunch of others who Nidart will come back to me in a moment. But it's really interesting. It's kind of a, you know how people kind of lost their shit about the Hogwarts houses and which one they belong to? And then later on, mm-hmm. they kind of lost their shit about Veronica Roth's Divergent series, you know, which group do they belong to in that?
Yeah.
Are they Dauntless? Are they Abnegation? What have you? We love multiple choice personality tests. We seem to really, really jive off them as humans.
I mean, there's a reason BuzzFeed's quizzes are so popular.
Yeah,
what type of bread roll am I?
I mean, it's stupid, but it's something that's quite addictive. Well, Vampire the Masquerade predates all of these, and this was a case of when a human is embraced, they call it the embrace, when a vampire makes a human into a vampire, they become part of the clan that the vampire who embraced them actually. So they become part of the same clan. So if mm-hmm. if you were, you know, say Brujas are, you know, quite violent, very pack mentality, get a lot of shit done, don't really respect a lot of authority, then you tend to go in that way. And because you've used Bruja, you know, because your maker was a Bruja, then you tend to have that bloodline. So it's various different bloodlines that cause these clans, and you have different strengths and weaknesses. Like the Ventru, the ones who are really good at running shit, tend to be very urbane, very good at, I suppose, they've got very magnetic, charismatic personalities, and they're good at getting you to do what they want you to do.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
you become part of this. I mean, you wouldn't want to be Nosferatu, really, because they are so horribly disfigured they can't be seen during the day, but they are kind of the I would say that they've got great minds for invention and working out how that they're strategists, and so they can see what's going to be useful for the future. So that they're absolutely have got strengths. It's just they can't ever go out. They can't go out where humans can see them, because no one would look at them and go, "Oh, that's not a vampire. That's a human."
Oh my god!
So I mean, apparently somebody chooses to be a Nosferatu. I mean, fair enough. I think what it is with all these different clans, for example, is there is something within each clan that echoes within the person who kind of wants to role play that particular character. And a lot of it is down to either it's something they feel they can't express themselves, that mm-hmm. that is within them, or perhaps it's something that they'd like to have more of. Perhaps they would like to be more compelling and magnetic, and this is a safe way to do it. Or, you know, perhaps they would like to be more down with their inner animal and not respect authority, and again, it's a safer way to do it. It's amazingly compulsive, from what I've seen, from the people who do actually get involved in this. And as I said, the world is huge. The world building is actually fascinating. From a writer's perspective, it's kind of like, yeah, that is how you build a world. And this game, which just started off as a simple D&D variation, has spawned a library of books. It spawned a television series starring many people that Joss Whedon later then stole for Buffy the Vampire Slayer. it spawned at least one PC game, and there is a new video game of Vampire the Masquerade coming out in the next, I think it's in 2 years' time. They're still working on it. But even I look at it and think, wow, that looks amazing. As long as that's more story-driven and quest-focused, I might actually play it. So it's just a really interesting sort of, when you were saying that there's various different types of the tabletop D&D, here's a really good example.
So you've touched on it a little bit just now, but I want to kind of expand on why roleplay appeals to us. Why do people like to roleplay? I'm very conscious of the fact that every time I say roleplay, it could be construed as a sexy thing. And sure, let's throw that in there as well. I'm sure there's reasons why people like to roleplay in that as well, and that a lot of this is applicable on the games rather than the sexy stuff. But sure, take what you want from it. So I think one of the big things that attracts roleplay to, or rather that attracts people to roleplay, attracts roleplay to people. Like, roleplay is some sentient creature that climbs through your window. Well, hey, I'm here. Oh, God!
That really
time
is
to
terrifying.
Dress up, bitch! I may have been traumatized as a child. Anyway, so I think it's to do with the fact that we love to play other people. And there's a number of reasons why that might be the case. I think there's a certain element of power in stepping out of your own skin and becoming something else. And weirdly enough, by being someone else, you can actually explore parts of yourself which might otherwise have been closeted or hidden, or you couldn't quite touch on them. It can be as simple as that, or it can be as complicated as saying, actually, I want to be a boy, but everyone calls me a girl. Or even that, actually, I'm kind of happy being a girl, but a part of me wants to be a boy. Or things along those lines. It gives you the chance to just be something else, or in some ways, be the version of yourself that's inside rather than outside. So yeah. I think that's something that appeals to everybody.
And it can be a cyclical thing as well, because, okay, I know this is really stretching the idea of role-playing, but, I mean, things like if you have a regular tradition, say, for Halloween or for New Year's Eve, where you go out and get dressed up, some people do it and they go as very similar characters every year. They may not be the same one. It's not a case of, yeah, I'm recycling my costume because I'm too cheap to buy a new one. Or make a new one. Sometimes it is literally a case of, I feel a strong connection to this character. So, for example, there was a fellow Wiccan type bloke who regularly, the costume was not all the same, but it was a sort of wolfish character. But the actual costume itself, he was kind of like, sometimes it was a wolf policeman, sometimes it was a wolf something else, Victorian gentleman, whatever. So he was always working within the parameters of this sort of aspect of his personality, but then adding a bit of flair to it. And it was just really interesting until sort of about 10 years ago. And he sort of said, oh, you know, that part of my personality is now so much part of my personality that I don't feel the need to dress up like that. That's not something I have to take out and air once a year. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it makes total sense.
Hopefully that doesn't mean he actually had learned how to turn into a wolf or anything. No, it was just really interesting.
But it might have just been, an extreme version of something smaller that he wanted to explore.
Yeah, and I would say, personally, I always used to get dressed up for Halloween and for New Year's Eve. And I almost always went as some sort of Celtic goddess. And you know how unpleasant a lot of the Celtic goddesses are.
They are.
I don't go out for New Year's Eve anymore. I would rather stay in and watch the lights and the fireworks on the television. That's how sad I am. But that used to be a yearly thing, and it was fun, and it wasn't just going out on the pool. In fact, it wasn't going out on the pool. I don't know what I'm talking about there at all. It wasn't going out on the pool at all. It was a chance to go out and be somebody who I wasn't, I suppose, or be a little addition of somebody who I was without getting a lot of very strange looks and, you know, what the hell are you talking about? Because I didn't have a lot of friends who were into folklore and mythology and, I suppose, self-actualizing the different aspects of your personality before. So, you know, it was a consequence-free environment to do it in.
I do think that people conspire to create scenarios whereby they can do that. And it's this very peculiar thing whereby we sort of look at dressing up and we're like, oh gosh, no, I'm not sure about dressing up, and oh, that's a bit embarrassing. And yet we as a species create these occasions whereby we can all do it without anyone looking weird, because everybody's doing it. and we relish in it, and we really enjoy those occasions. We look forward to them. We put a lot of importance on them, whether that be a masquerade, whether that be a Halloween party, whether it just be a regular kind of costume party or other form of game. We actually really relish it. And I think as Whitby we're going on, people are getting more into it.
I was going to say, Whitby Goth Festival is like a really good good example of that too. And it's a really good fun. Highly recommend it if anyone wants to go somewhere, wear a lot of leather and black eye makeup, or corsets or what have you, and not get pointed at during the day. Go for that.
Sounds amazing. And one thing that I feel that this touches on is that it's something that we've actually been doing for years and years and years. And I want to actually touch on the stage and improvisation. Because even though earlier on I talked about the fact, I said that we were looking in particular at situations where you were where you had choice. If we look at kind of the history of theatre, yes, a lot of it was staged, it was scripted, but in certain areas and certain forms of theatre, like Commedia dell'arte, you would have improvisation, and a lot of it would be improvised. So you'd know the direction you were going in, and you'd know certain things had to happen, but there was this openness. Now, Commedia dell'arte always really interested me because there was this phenomenon where they would all be wearing masks. And the moment the mask went on, they were that character. And they couldn't break out of character. In order to break out of character and become the actors themselves, they had to take the mask off. It was meant to be this sensation of complete submersion into the story. And for me, I felt like the kind of people who'd be attracted to that would also probably be the kind of people who'd probably enjoy doing D&D. And they would be comedians. They would be very physical as well. But they would be driving certain parts of the story. And they would be that character. They would totally become them. And I always found that really, really interesting. And I think that the whole D&D thing just pulls on something which is innate within us. And I think that pretty much every child I know has indulged in some sort of fantasy whereby they're the hero, whether they are being firemen or whether they're, you know, wizards or knights or anything like that. We play those kinds of games as children. We can do it. We can get away with it. We can run around and our imaginations are unchecked. And it's almost easier in a lot of ways.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a part of the process, isn't it? Every child at some point plays let's pretend or make believe or whatever you want to call it. I always, going back to primary school, but they used to play, I'm sure, it sounds so sad, but all the kids wanted to play mummies and daddies, because what you do as a very young child is you imitate adults.
And yeah.
I always found those games horrendously boring. I never wanted to be mummy. So there you go. There was a clue there really early on. And whenever I was in charge of the game, it got quite, I want to say dark, but there were things like suddenly it wasn't a game of mummies and daddies where we were creating a house and a family or what have you. Suddenly we were all shipwrecked on an island and learning to hunt. Yeah.
Oh, Jules.
What can I say? I've always played to die. And it was interesting because the minute I was talking about, no, we must survive, so we're going to have to kill these rabbits and this deer, and I would lose quite a lot of the girls in the audience and the more sensitive boys at that point. But then I'd end up with basically my own little tribe of lost boys who were kind of really invested in this game.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
I think it was the same, actually, to be honest. I'm very invested in kind of games like that. My games usually involved all sorts of crazy nonsense. And I think that actually the thing that is born of that is fan fiction. Yeah. And I am going to include fan fiction here because I do think it is almost another limb of the whole role-playing thing. Now, you might say, but it's not a game. But it is, actually. Because actually the role-playing game is in itself just the telling of a story where there are where decisions are being made. You now, when you're writing fan fiction, usually if you're writing on your own, you are in charge of everything. So you are both the player and the dungeon master, as they're so called. But you get all of those elements from the tabletop game, except for perhaps the rolling of the dice and things like that. And to be honest, you can actually still kind of write fan fiction like that as well.
Yeah, that's what all the prompts and things are for in some of the really big fandoms. Sort of like, I want to see a torture scene between character X and character Y, and there must be comfort and, you know, retribution. Someone just literally picks things out of a hat and the other person has to just somehow make all those elements combine.
Yeah. So ultimately you have more of a choice and there's less of a, you decide on the consequences as well. So the game aspect is taken out of it. But I do think it's an important part of the whole world in terms of where D&D comes from. And it, fan fiction literally is this idea of, I love this world and I want to exist in it in some form. So you are living vicariously through characters, either by manipulating the characters who already exist, or, as so often is the case, and as so often people kind of turn their noses down or turn their noses up at, creating original characters within that world. Surprised that those original characters will often actually be what is referred to as Mary Sue, so they might be self-inserts, but they're perfected self-inserts. Exactly the kinds of characters you would play in Dungeons and Dragons. So I think it's all part of the same world.
Yeah, definitely. It's, as we've said before in a previous episode, lots of writers who go on to actually write in some sort of career capacity have actually come from the fan fiction minds. It's a good place to discover what your own character is so that you can then create other believable characters. Obviously, I didn't quite come from that direction, but yeah. Apparently, I imbibed fantasy in other ways, and I did it more as a solo pursuit. But yeah, if you want to engage with other people when you do it, the same way you do when you play D&D or you LARP or whatever, or you do murder mystery with other groups of people, and it is the shared fantasy, it's the shared belief, it's the shared story, and the whole idea of us being wired for story, both to learn from them, be entertained by them, and in some respects to be sustained by story, is as ancient as the human race is itself. Partly absolutely, because we need to explain things, and partly because once you've got your basic food, shelter, companionship sorted out, then what you really need is story, however you choose to take it.
Yeah, I completely agree. So now I kind of want to talk about our own sort of experiences in terms of role playing, because I think we both have we have different experiences. We've tried it in sort of different ways. Again, every time I say that, it sounds so odd.
The fact is, until you sort of said, oh, actually, that sounds a bit dicey, I was kind of like, it's fine. So it's your mind that's taking it there, Madeline. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm Mistress Spanx a lot the whole time. It's not a role for me. Joking, obviously.
okay, so I think probably one of the most accessible forms of role-playing, which, and I say it's accessible because you can do it from your home without having to meet up with others, is probably video games.
Yeah, definitely. And that's almost the sum total of my role-playing experience, if you want to call it that. I'm not a massive... I would have said, actually, to be fair, I would have said I'm not a massive gamer. That's not true. I am a massive gamer when it's a game that interests me. I won't play things just because it's the new thing out. If it doesn't have elements that draw me in and interest me, I would rather get my fantasy fix or whatever in a completely different format. However, mm-hmm. the minute a new Elder Scrolls game comes out, I take a week off work because there is no way Alan is finishing that and spoiling it before I get there. This is what happened with Skyrim. Both Alan and I bought our own copies of this game and we played it simultaneously in the same house in separate rooms and compared notes later. It was a weird couples thing to do that didn't involve actually being together, but, you know, we did it. And I know that there's another couple who did pretty much the same thing. Because everybody wants something a bit different out of it. And the Bethesda studio games are really good. They have massive open worlds with some, you know, tight stories in there that you can follow. And literally the world is kind of your oyster. You can, if you want to spend the entire time just picking Nern Root, which one of my friends does, then you can. If you want to follow the main story arc, you can do that. If you want to do all the little side quests, which, to be honest, I think are the best bits, then you can track all those down. And they are redoable. This is not a... You can go in, create a different character, take it on a slightly different path. So yeah, they're great. Alan plays a lot of the others as well. So things like Halo and Fallout. Fallout looks great, but I'm just not very interested in the guns, so...
Yeah.
But I love the world building. I find the world building really interesting.
Yeah. I think my first experience with a role-playing game, video game, was probably Dragon Age, the first Dragon Age. I'd watched someone else play Fable and things like that, but the first time I was really sat down and doing it was Dragon Age. And I realised actually why video games were so dangerous for me, because I just was just playing and playing and playing and playing, and I suddenly went, oh no, this is not good for my addictive personality. So I had to kind of distance myself a little bit after that. But yeah, I really, really did enjoy it, and it appealed to me in so many ways, because I had this great character who I really, really enjoyed. I liked the fact that you could design them. I mean, to be honest, it was like Sims. Everyone likes Sims because everyone likes creating these characters.
I get Sims from someone else's perspective, particularly if it's someone who kind of wants to impose a lot of order on their life but can't, so Sims is quite a good substitute. For me personally, there is nothing there to interest me. There's nothing that engages me at all.
See, I always really liked it because I liked the designing of the characters, and that was unique. I really, really kind of want to point that out. The Sims did something that was really, really unique in terms of having this character design and being able to manipulate things in that way. And I liked doing I liked creating the characters, and then I liked kind of, you know, making the houses, because you could do all sorts of stuff with it, and I'm quite into interior design and things like that, so it was great fun. And then they were there and I was like, I don't really care about them anymore. There's nothing really that fun going on actually from this point. And so you just continue to create more and more Sims. Never do anything with them, because I wasn't actually interested in them keeping house. It just didn't. That was something I was doing anyway in my real life. It was just this sort of appeasing this fantasy of having limitless amounts of money and being able to have this amazing house and creating characters based on old characters that were real or etc. Whatever. And obviously now in The Sims you can incorporate all these supernatural creatures as well, and you can have fun in that way too. But The Sims was amazing in the way that it basically picked up on something that everyone loved doing, which was creating characters. And now these role-playing games allowed you to do the same thing, and you could create the way they looked, you could choose their background, and then you could actually do something with them in terms of fighting. And the great thing was that it got bigger and bigger and bigger. So in Dragon Age, you were still kind of heading in one particular direction, and you didn't have a lot of control. You could control who your companions were, what kind of quests you accepted, and who you romanced. And that was amazing at the time. I had great fun with that. But then it's just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And I have not touched Skyrim. I've not touched Skyrim because I know that when I do, I will never emerge.
How have you gone this long?
I'm literally afraid.
Seriously, how have you gone this long and not picked up Skyrim? Skyrim's amazing.
I don't have a computer which is going to be able to support Skyrim. I'm not going to lie. And, you know, maybe if I could play it on something else, I might start. But I would need to book out like a month, because I think that would be me gone. And I just, I've never had the time. I haven't done it.
So, I mean, to be fair, I don't really have the time, but somehow I will make the time for an Elder Scrolls game.
Yeah, but the problem with me is that literally everything would be on hold. Even when everything is on hold with you, Jules, you are incredibly efficient. I am not. When I become obsessed with something, that's it. I don't do anything else. I hyper-fixate. Like, I will forget to eat. Sometimes I even forget to breathe. I'm like, oh, God, yeah. So transfixed. I wasn't breathing. So, yeah, it's a bit dangerous. But I will one day be able to sit down and play Skyrim, hopefully when I've actually got a proper computer to be able to do that. But yeah, so I don't actually play a lot of video games for that reason. Every now and again I'll dip in, and I like watching video games as well, and I'll sit while someone else is playing them, and that's great fun. But actually, I indulge in the role-playing game in different ways. So I don't really do video games, but I have actually done part of D&D campaigns. I have a character, she's a half-elf. She's a drunkard. It's great fun. The first thing my character did having woke up, the beginning of our campaign, it was great fun. The beginning of our campaign, the three characters wake up in a ditch, in a giant hole, and they've all been knocked unconscious and fallen through and they can't get out again. And the first thing she does is they find an injured, asks him for something to drink. He can give her nothing to drink. They creep in and they find these occultists who are clearly up to no good. And again, the first thing my character does is grab the nearest one and go, "The wine! Where is the ceremonial wine?" She then proceeds to brain herself on a table. It was great. She had a lot of fun. And I had even more fun playing as her. So I really have enjoyed that. To the extent that I actually have started to build a Hamartia-based D&D game, and I'm planning a campaign with some friends, which I've tried to pull Jules into, but I think she's still suspicious of it.
I'm not. It wasn't that at all. What I said was, I'm worried about being able to commit the time.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough.
And I don't want to be the person who's kind of like, oh, you can't do it this week because I, again, I'm cancelling on you, so... So no, it wasn't suspicion. It was a case of, if you're going to say, yeah, once a month we're going to do this, I could commit to it. If it was going to be once a week, it's going to be an issue.
It would never be once a week, but yeah.
But yeah, otherwise I'm totally up for it.
I'm just going to put it out now. It's great fun creating your own D&D game, because D&D is complicated. Like, reading every single module. When I was just creating my own character, it took an entire day to just create the character, and even then I was still so unsure about so much of the things that were happening. So to be able to create your own version with your own rules and stuff like that, because there's a lot of lore as well that you kind of had to learn, a lot of background, has been absolutely great fun. So we'll see kind of where that goes. But as well as the tabletop games, I would love to LARP. I would really, really love to LARP, and I've never had the courage to. And I think probably to is that even if I put on a costume, I very much doubt I would look anything like what I wanted to look like. And when you're playing role-playing games, you can have characters who are like jumping off roofs and stuff like that. But if you're LARPing, a little bit harder. Tinsy bit harder, particularly if you yourself are not great at jumping off of roofs. But one way that I do LARP is, as Jules has mentioned, I write murder mystery games. And I specifically write them to improv, and I love attending them because then I get to be in character, and because I'm running them, I'm also usually the one with all the secrets, so I get to go around being like, well, yes, but she knows something, doesn't she? Excuse me. And then drift off, and it's great because I've done so many versions. I've been like an heiress from like the 1920s. I've been an assassin from like in a Victorian era. I've been everything. It's been great fun. I've been a detective. It's so much fun. You can have so much fun with it.
Yeah, it was really good fun. The one I came to.
Yes.
On Madeline's birthday. That was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. I particularly liked it, though. It was quite interesting, because, yeah, it was the one I did for my birthday, and I was actually there as Kestrel. But, like, and it was really funny as well, because I was there being Kestrel, typical Kestrel, and you were there being someone who was referred to as the witch.
No, I was referred to as the Irish witch, thank you.
The Irish witch, that's right, yeah. And so it just meant that
Kestrel
we spent the whole
like
evening growling at each other. Yeah,
it was. We spent the entire evening bickering and laughing. That was a lot of laughing.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, though, I was in quite a weird position in the most recent one I did, which my dad's girlfriend was there. And by sheer fluke, I was playing the daughter of the murdered victim, and she was playing my stepmother. And we hated each other.
Oh.
So I spent the whole evening having to be like, oh yes, she's a gold digger and all this stuff. And then afterwards I'd be like, I don't mean any of it. I mean I felt so guilty because she was playing a horrible character, but she's a really nice person.
Yeah.
I was really worried that people are going to be like, is there any truth to this? Is this really how you feel? And absolutely no, it wasn't. So there was kind of a little bit of a danger in that kind of role play as well, in how much of it is true and how much of it is fiction.
Yeah, I think like anything, it's one of those things where you kind of need enough people who are going to commit to actually having a go at it to make
it
work.
I've absolutely found that, yeah, because all it takes is one person not being committed and the whole thing can really fall apart. And it is actually about creating that bubble. And again, it brings me back to that commedia dell'arte, which is when the mask is on, everybody is in character. And there is this phenomenon where I say that they will be better, they will act better when they're acting with someone who's also very, very good, because you get submersed into this fantasy. So when everyone around you is able to do that, you can have amazing results, to the point that, I mean, I think that's kind of actually how mass hysteria can occur.
Yeah,
that people
actually
can get so convinced by everything that's happening around them that it can potentially be dangerous. Actually, an obsessive quality that comes with role playing, whereby if you spend a lot of your time desperately trying to be somebody else, doing it recreationally, absolutely fine. Doing it as a form of therapy, even, absolutely fine. But when you can no longer distinguish the line between fantasy and reality, and you can no longer detangle those kinds of things, whereby when you want to completely leave reality behind, element of danger, I think.
Yeah, I have to say, I've got a couple of examples. First of all, I can't remember who this quote is by, but it's, we are what we pretend to be, therefore we must be very careful what we pretend to be. And, you know, that's generally quite good advice anyway, because if you spend your life pretending to be something, just in general, nothing to do with RPG, then eventually you will start to take on the characteristics of what you're pretending to be, because that will become you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they did a study whereby they faked a car accident. They faked a car having to stop suddenly and somebody falling off a push bike, and a crowd of people gathered round, and at the beginning everybody was absolutely certain the car had not hit the bike, and they basically put a plant, not an actual plant, but a plant, a planted a person. They planted them. Okay, perhaps a plant is the wrong word. An agent provocateur. They put a person who was shouting constantly about how the car had hit the bike and how dangerously the driver was driving, etc. And then other people started to join in. And by the end of it, everybody believed that the car had hit the bike, even though it was staged and it hadn't happened. And it clearly hadn't happened, and later cameras showed that it hadn't happened. Even after that, everybody was still certain that the car had hit the bike. So when you were talking about things like mass hysteria, we actually are very susceptible to having our perception shifted slightly. If we've got one very strong voice, then people will tend to join in. And yeah, I do think RPG kind of taps into that to a certain extent. Certainly politicians, without going into politics, do also tap into that. And actors make you believe things. I mean, in the same way that writers lie to tell you a good story, actors lie with their entire beings to tell you a good story, to the point where people couldn't basically distinguish Lena Headey from her character Cersei Lannister. And she was getting a lot of crap in person at conventions where people were coming up to her and saying, "I don't like you," because they couldn't see her as anybody except Cersei. So
which is where that difficulty kind of it does lie.
And particularly if it's a world you want to be immersed in, if you want it that badly, because it's supplying something that your life currently lacks. There's nothing wrong with that, but you have to find, as a way of exploring how to get what you're currently lacking in your life, it's great. And as entertainment or relaxation or relief or whatever, again, it's great. But sometimes it can start to take over. And I don't think this is an especially common thing, but you do hear about people who LARP especially who then get so involved that they have difficulty sort of maintaining the rest of their lives. And I'm thinking of one person in particular who was a friend of mine, and he unfortunately had some mental health issues. Not his fault, obviously, this is a chemical imbalance in his brain, but he was playing Vampire the Masquerade, and at the point where his mental health issues kind of really hit their peak, he could no longer tell the difference between what was Vampire the Masquerade and what was actually the rest of the world. And he did some very, very peculiar stuff, as put it mildly. So this is not me saying, oh, you mustn't role play, you must live your staid little lives even though you're bored and miserable. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, you know, occasionally reality check, I guess, is what I'm going for here.
Yeah. And also to be able to kind of separate those things as well, even though they are interlinked. And you can maintain a very healthy kind of relationship in terms of fantasizing. In fact, I would go so far as to say that fantasizing is an incredibly healthy thing to do.
Definitely.
In whatever form. And D&D, in particular, in general, can also be a very social thing to do. Not that it needs to be, but it can be. So I think a lot of people could benefit from doing it. I think that it's a great stress reliever as well. It's a great way of exploring yourself. So I'm all for it, and I partake in it. And it would be very, very hypocritical for me as a writer to turn around and say, no, you must not do those things. Because every time I write a book, that's essentially what I am, escaping reality. I think that we're kind of designed to do that to a certain degree.
Yeah.
But I also think that escaping reality to the point where you can start to neglect reality itself in terms of your health, in terms of your life, in terms of taking care of yourself and others, and maintaining other relationships, that's when it becomes an issue. And I'm not talking about sort of, staying abusive relationships and then, or anything like that. I'm just talking about healthy, normal relationships, because they can come into jeopardy when any form of obsession is involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So before we kind of go, because I realise that the clock is ticking, I just kind of wanted to sort of have a very, very quick look at what makes a successful campaign, do you think, in any form of role play?
Well, bear in mind, obviously, mine's quite limited because I'm not the most social animal, therefore I tend to like to play alone. Like, the trouble with you having said all the whole sort of role play sex thing earlier. Now that I'm like, I like to play alone. I don't like to have anyone on my team. And it sounds really dicey in my head now.
You can suffer with me.
I think the idea, a good story, but a good story led in a way that doesn't stifle the actions of the character. In this case, you, the role player. So yeah. I've heard it said that a really good dungeon master is somebody who doesn't keep trying to nudge the characters to do what he or she wants them to do. So if the bunch of characters say, oh, look, there's a tavern over there. Oh, and all the wyverns are attacking. Oh, God. And he wanted them to, you know, fight the wyverns. But instead they're like, no, we're going to hide in the tavern. And, oh, look at all this wine. We've all got really, really pissed. A good dungeon master is the one who lets them do it the way that they've chosen to and rolls with it from there.
Yeah. That being said, you shouldn't make it your mission in life to completely ruin all the work that your dungeon master has done.
Oh, no, absolutely. This is not being this is not a case of, you know, being a dick as a participant. This is a case of, okay, the entire party's saying, we don't want to fight the wyverns, let's hide in there for a moment, which might be sensible, but leads to other decisions rather than let's fuck everything up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. And in terms of what makes a good campaign, it's very much what makes a good story in general, because ultimately that is what you are doing. So having that element of choice, but also having engaging characters, you will find that your campaign is more interesting if you have a diverse kind of characters who have all sorts of kind of different characteristics and different histories. It's why actually having so many different species and backgrounds and options is so enticing, I think, because it makes for a more diverse group of characters. So that's one of the initial things, but also having forms of crises. And one of the things you do when you have a campaign is that you will have you're usually asked to have a kind of secret. And it's not very often that you'll have a character who's just 100% happy. It does happen, but for the most part, there is usually a dark past in some form or another.
Yeah.
Or some tragedy. And then that's often incorporated into the game itself. So I think basically all the things that make a successful campaign are pretty much the exact same that make a successful book. It just goes on for longer.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. You want a satisfying conclusion. You want difficulties and crises, but also some fun stuff as well. And on that note, I think we've run out of time, Jules.
Yeah, we've definitely come to the end.
Please do leave us comments. What your experience with role-playing games are. What kind of things do you enjoy? Are you a seasoned D&D player? Are you someone who just can't get out of Skyrim? Let us know. And if you have any suggestions for games or things that you think we should try out, leave it in the comments as well. Before we go, though, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, I've got a weird one for you. It is a series which has been recently revamped. It's an anime series called Dororo. Dororo was an incredibly old manga, and I think an old manga, an anime as well, which has recently been revamped. It is not for the faint of heart. I'm putting that out there right now. It's definitely not for young children as well. There are some incredibly mature themes, and some rather nasty stuff does happen. So you might want to avoid it if you're someone who just kind of wants a really just a fun time of it. It's definitely not that at all. It concerns itself with a young person named Dororo who meets up with a warrior who, when Dororo meets up with this warrior called Hyakimaru, Hyakimaru has no skin, no limbs, no actual spine, I believe.
Ew.
Yeah. And it's basically completely made up of prosthetics. And what happens is that Hyakimaru's basically everything was sold to demons. And every time he kills a demon, he gets something back. So he'll get his skin back, and then he gets his ears back and his nose, and his limbs and things like that. And it is actually quite, so that alone will tell you that it's a little bit gory as well. And so he starts on this journey to get his body back, and Dororo joins him. And it's a short series. It's a completed series. It's definitely worth watching. Very, very enjoyable. As I said, not for the faint of heart. But the thing I particularly like about it is that it uses a lot of old Japanese mythology in terms of the demons that Yajimaru has to face. So definitely worth watching. That's the new series, Dororo. Look out for the new one rather than the old one, but you can definitely watch the old one as well. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.